From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. About speech and words, writers express diverse opinions. Percy Shelley, for instance, called speech the creator of thought, the measure of the universe. By contrast, T.S. Eliot wrote that beneath the burden of meaning, words slip, slide, perish, decay with imprecision. Those are poetic views of language. What do professional linguists say about speech and the use of words? How do Americans use English? To what social, aesthetic, or political ends? Soundings now presents the first of two programs about language and linguistics. The panelists are three sociolinguists: Crawford Fagan, Walt Wolfram, and Ron Butters. Crawford Fagan is a professor at the University of Virginia at Falls Church. Walt Wolfram is director of research at the Center for Applied Linguistics and a professor at the University of the District of Columbia. Ron Butters is the editor of American Speech, a linguistics journal published at Duke University. The discussion begins with comments from Crawford Fagan about whether there is such a thing as American English.
Well, actually, it's been a question that's been debated for the ever since our revolution, in fact, whether American English is the same or different from particularly British English. And obviously, anybody with ears today could hear that there's quite a difference. But defining it becomes rather difficult. You can go through an inventory one by one and say this is different from that and that's different from the other. The most obvious one that the layman runs across are a series of vocabulary differences, such as we say apartment and the British say flat, and we say truck and they say, what did the British say? Anyway.
Lorry.
Lorry, that's right. Mm-hmm. And you go down those. That's the easiest to put your finger on. But the British, when you think of British speech, you think of RP, or high-class British style. Uh-huh. And in that, they don't pronounce the final R's. And in mostly in the U.S., Americans do have R's. And that's a simple comparative. But again, it gets very... very complex if you try to point at one particular item.
Well, the aesthetics of language differs in the groups. It's interesting because we've done surveys and asked North Americans which dialect they like. Basically, they don't really like any of the dialects.
And by dialect, you mean what?
Well, one of the regional varieties of the language. So, for example, a dialect might be New York City, Philadelphia, Detroit, Midwest, Southern, Appalachian, and so forth. But the interesting thing is that Americans tend to be relatively neutral. So if you say, is there a dialect that you really like a lot? Not really. Yeah, some are okay, some aren't too good. But now you say British English, and then all of a sudden it's highly favored. Mm-hmm. It may not even be a middle-class variety of British English, but it's good. So there is kind of an aesthetic difference between how Americans view American English versus British English.
Ron Butters?
And I think perhaps in part you're responding there to just one variety of British English, and that's the kind that's most frequently exported to this country.
Now, what's that called?
Corky use the term RP. This is a received pronunciation, and this would be the standard pronunciation of Oxford, Cambridge,
Laurence the BBC, Olivier, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. This is probably a minority dialect in Britain, but that's what we hear most frequently exported to this side of the Atlantic.
So kind of highfalutin English talk.
Sure.
Yeah.
As far as responses to American dialects are concerned, within the United States, there are people who will say, oh, I just love to hear them talk. And they're usually talking about Southern speech, or occasionally Boston speech, I think, has, especially sort of Beacon Hill Boston, has a certain sort of prestige value. But I think Walt's right about the neutral goals of American speech. We tend not to want to say anything that makes it stand out. And any kind of sort of lowest common denominator then of pronunciation is it's not so much that it has a prestige value, but anything else has sort of negative prestige.
I personally define standard English as a negative notion. Basically, if you don't have certain socially stigmatized features in your speech, that is, things like double negatives, he didn't do nothing, I ain't gone, and who done it, and so forth. If you don't say those sorts of things, then basically, in terms of how we really operate with the notion of standard English and spoken language, your English is considered to be okay and standard. Now, there's another thing that goes along with that. What that does is, if you define standard English as the absence of these socially stigmatized things, then what you get is you actually get standard Englishes, if you'll excuse the pluralization of that, so that there is a standard English in New England, there is a standard English in New York City, there is a standard English in Texas, you know, various towns in Texas and so forth.
In other words, stuff that just sounds natural to the local people.
That doesn't call attention to itself because it has something that is viewed negatively about mm-hmm. it.
Now, you've used the word standards a couple of times. One of the hot issues, we're in a presidential election season. One of the hot issues is education. How much attention do you pay to standards of American English? Who sets the agenda there? Do you even worry about things like that, the language rising and falling in terms of so-called standards?
Well, there's the problem of written English, mm-hmm. which is one thing, but spoken English is something quite again. In this country, we don't teach people how to pronounce items in the classroom, but we certainly insist that people write in a particular way and have agreement and don't leave out and to leave out double negatives and to write correctly. We have a clear idea of what it means to write correctly, but I'm not sure we have quite as clear an idea, aside from the grammar, as to what it means to speak correctly.
The formal standard is pretty much set for us by writing guides, prescriptive grammars. That is a prescriptive thing. People tell us. The authorities, whether they have the authority or not, they tell us. On the other hand, there's an informal standard, whereas people in actual social situations make judgments about people as to whether their speech is acceptable in terms of their perception of them. So I think it's important to distinguish between the formal and informal notion of standard English. In some instances, things which might be quite standard in writing come out quite affected when you speak. And there's a negative connotation to that. You see, one of the interesting things, of course, is that in our society, because we think of it in terms of education, we think that all positive values are associated with standards. There are actually some very important prestige values, they may be covert, attached to non-standard dialects. The problem is we think that there are only positive values with standards because the questions that we ask about standards tend to be phrased in terms of middle-class educational expectations.
I'd like to go back to the neutral notion just a little bit more. I was talking yesterday with a young man who has just taken a job as a flight attendant with a major American airline, who comes from New York City, and the interview was held someplace in the South, and he said, "I thought I should be really very careful not to sound like I was from New York, but I couldn't sound like I was from the South either, so I just tried to sound like I was from nowhere," and apparently it worked because he got the job. Now, I think that, or make the same kind of comparison with the political arena and the presidents we've had in the last 30 years. Now, not the only reason that Eisenhower was a successful politician was not because he sounded relatively neutral, or I think the only reason that Reagan has been quite successful is not because he sounds relatively neutral, but nonetheless. If you compare his speech patterns with Jimmy Carter's speech patterns or Lyndon Johnson's speech patterns or even
Kennedy.
Yeah, Kennedy, though, had a certain plus, that sort of special Boston accent, which is kind of associated with received pronunciation, with British English. That Kennedy, I think, is something of an exception. But Hollings, people made fun of Hollings' accent in
the senator from South Carolina.
Right. Even in the South, people made fun of his. There were cartoons in the Durham Morning Herald putting him down because he said, at one point he said, "I'm not communicating with other people." And the point of the cartoon was he wasn't communicating with other people because they couldn't understand him because he was speaking funny Southern speech. But if you speak something neutral, like a Gary Hart or like a Ronald Reagan, I think your chances are really better.
Let me ask you to consider this from your standpoint as professional linguists. What do linguists do with language? What happens to the stuff that you do as linguists? Do you intend it for it to have any kind of an impact on the language?
Well, I think that you could say that they're dictionary makers who are not exactly linguists, but I don't think that linguists get into the rule-making business.
Well, it's kind of a difficult question to answer because of some popular notions. Let me see if I can discount a popular notion to begin with. First of all, there's this notion that linguists think anything goes in language. Linguists do not think anything goes in language. Now, what linguists do, however, is try to describe the language as it is spoken by real people, all right? In trying to describe language as it's spoken by real people, as they interact for communicative purposes, sometimes what we describe does not match the rules of the standard variety. And that's where we have, our conflict. And that's where sometimes linguists are misinterpreted. So rather than look at the use of a double negative like in he didn't do nothing, in terms of whether it's right or wrong, what a linguist is interested in is observing the pattern. How does that rule work? Does it work something like the rule in Spanish where they have double negatives and so you say no hace nada? He doesn't do anything, or does it work differently? So basically, linguists get caught up in trying to describe language as it's used, rather than what the standards of language are, what they should be.
So what do you do with these patterns? Where does that, does it just go into books that people don't read, or what?
Well, I guess we read each other's books.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think the ultimate desire, in some practical sense, is to have some sort of impact on education so that the person from, let's say, a non-standard dialect is not penalized in some areas where it's unimportant. Now, if someone is going to write, if someone is going to teach English, you want them to speak standard English in the classroom and to be able to write standard English. But if that's not the goal, then it's ridiculous to have, say, a test for policemen that includes the necessity to be able to write standard English. I don't want to say policemen in particular, but any group that has no immediate need for that sort of thing. Walt has worked in that extensively, and maybe he should say more about that.
Well, before I say that, though, I think it's important to note here that although linguists in themselves might be perfectly happy to read each other's works, there are some important fallouts in terms of dialect differences, language variety as it exists in American society. There was a court case in Ann Arbor a few years ago in which some young black children in Ann Arbor brought a suit against the school system because they spoke a variety which was not the language used in the schools, and they wanted their language taken into account in terms of teaching them how to read. This does not mean they wanted to be taught in their variety. All they wanted to do was have teachers recognize the variety and take it into account. Another, for instance, speech pathologists are in the position of making assessments about children's language, whether it's normal or disorder. So if you know what the dialects of these different communities are, then you're in a position to make an authentic judgment about the nature of normal language versus non-normal language, which becomes very important in terms of classifying kids, in terms of treatment of kids, in terms of providing the full benefits of the educational system.
The legal implications are very interesting. I've been recently had occasion to look at the transcripts of that were used as evidence in a court case in the South, and the FBI had transcribed the people doing the FBI transcription obviously didn't know the dialect they were dealing with, and so when they would transcribe words such as wasn't, which in the South is sometimes pronounced something like wouldn't, transcribe this as wouldn't. Now, if a jury looks at this, there can be some very crucial cases in which the meaning of what was said and what was written is really quite different.
There are lots of legal questions that boil down to what does a person really mean when they say something. There was a case up in New Haven some years ago with the Black Panthers, for example, in which the statement was uttered, "Let's off the pigs." So there are questions that boil down to how do you use and interpret language.
Well, what was the answer to that question, Walt? How was it interpreted?
I believe the answer was that it did not constitute a legal threat. In the context mm-hmm. of that social situation, that would not constitute a legal threat. And several well-known recent legal cases have involved important issues of language. The Abscam trials, the DeLorean case, have all involved, if you look at these closely, matters of literal, non-literal language. How is language being used to accomplish various ends?
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the first of two discussions about language and linguistics. Should there be standards in American speech and writing? What do linguists say about bilingual education? The panelists for Soundings are three sociolinguists, Crawford Fagan, Walt Wolfram, and Ron Butters. Crawford Fagan teaches linguistics at the University of Virginia at Falls Church. Walt Wolfram is the director of research at the Center for Applied Linguistics and a professor at the University of the District of Columbia. Ron Butters teaches at Duke University, where he serves as editor of American Speech, a linguistics journal.
Well, then let me put to you a question that came up on an earlier Soundings that Ron Butters participated on. What do you say then to the defenders of English, people like John Simon, who say that it's just really rotting in our mouths and we really need to be worried about all these terrible things that are happening to our language? Are these, what, cultural conservatives who need to be ignored by the linguists, or are they shifting the burden to other areas that linguists aren't interested in? What?
Well, mainly, I think that they're just backwards-looking people. They mm-hmm. don't understand that language changes. It always changes. It always has changed. Most educated people in this society have read Chaucer at some time or another, whether it was translated into more modern English or not. But if you think of Chaucer and think of language today, or if you think of simply the King James translation of the Bible, language has changed, and it will continue to do so. It always has, and it's like sweeping back the sea. You're not going to stop it. And I think that they're spilling quite a lot of ink and a lot of anguish over these particular problems. And if you look very carefully at what each of these critics has to say, it turns out that they're often rather inconsistent within themselves. Some people despise hopefully, and they pick out particular items But if you look at it carefully, they may not use it themselves, but then they may use something else in a similar matter. And you can just keep going on down the road. It used to be perfectly acceptable in English to use double negatives. And it used to be perfectly acceptable in English to use certain, what are now non-standard preterites and past participles. I come, I run. But language has changed. We don't do that now. And some of it was slowed down at the time of Johnson and his dictionary. But still, language is going to continue to change.
Let me ask you to consider the question of bilingual education from your standpoints as linguists. Walt Wolfram said that it breaks down into at least two, it has two elements, a political element, and or I guess you'd call it a social element, as well as a linguistic element. What do linguists think about bilingual education? What are the various positions that they take?
Well, I think one position is that we've had bilingual education in this country for many, many years, and many people are simply not aware of it. And the idea that in the U.S. we should be totally English-speaking is actually a fallacy. We've had large groups of people come into this country speaking their own language for several generations, and then they switch over. It's inevitable. The Huguenots who came here to South Carolina, many Germans came to the Ohio Valley. There were German high schools throughout that area 50 years ago. They were wiped out during World War I with the anti-German feeling. But this idea of pristine English in this country is a relatively new idea. And I think that those people who see it differently just simply don't know their history. Walt, you have something to say.
You really can't divorce bilingualism from social class. And our views about bilingualism from social class. The middle classes tend to be strong advocates of bilingualism, at least the middle class, other language speaking groups. The working classes, it tends to be more of a handicap. If Kissinger speaks with a German accent, it's considered to be scholarly and erudite. If a working class German who works in an auto factory speaks with that same accent, it may be considered as an indication of his failure to learn English and ignorance. So there's again, we're dealing with bilingualism in terms of social class. And you can't divorce it from that aspect. And again, where people need to go. I personally think that the linguistic variable in bilingualism has been somewhat overstated.
In what way?
In this way. I've recently done studies with Vietnamese communities. All right, people who came to the United States speaking no English, now after a year or two, speak heavily influenced English in terms of native Vietnamese. Now, the argument is always that kids won't succeed in school if they can't gain access through their own language. But here's what I found in the study, is that the kids in my study are highly motivated and are succeeding in school, despite the language background. Now, I'm not saying that they don't have a higher hurdle to overcome than native speakers of English. But it does give you cause to pause when you think that here's a group that is succeeding educationally, yet with a very serious language handicap to begin with.
I think that what we're seeing here is the same problem as the black English problem in the ghettos. It's not a language problem, but a social problem.
Yeah, it's a matter of where you want to go, and maybe it's unfair to look at a community that is very highly motivated to succeed in terms of traditional educational values. So maybe that's kind of a problem that I'm taking minimally, and maybe it should be maximized.
Ron Butters.
I grew up in a neighborhood in a relatively small town in Iowa in which all of the grandparents spoke Czech. All of the parents spoke All the parents spoke English, although there were some Czech flavors there, I think. We were very much a minority because we didn't happen to be Czech but lived in this neighborhood nonetheless. The medium of instruction in the schools was English, of course, and nobody objected to that at all. The Czech grandparents in my neighborhood pretty clearly had wanted their children to learn English. They were one neighborhood in a city in which another neighborhood spoke German, and the majority of the people spoke English. And they were surrounded by a countryside of English-speaking people, and they, I'm sure, saw the handwriting on the wall.
On the other hand, there are the practical problems. I believe that Fairfax County in Virginia has something like 50 different languages in the county, of mainly immigrants of one sort or another, many refugees, and that's a practical problem of materials, teachers, and so forth. So that's one of the practical aspects. So you have practical, you have political, and you have linguistic problems. I mean, questions there. So it's not a simple question, but also the idea that English only is the only answer isn't necessarily the case. It depends on the community and on the individuals. If you're on an Indian reservation, it seems rather natural to use Navajo in the schools and switch the children to English at some point, but to learn to read and write in Navajo, if that's what the parents want the children to do. But if you have Afghan children in a suburban school in Fairfax County in Virginia, I don't see that Fairfax County should have to provide materials and teachers in Afghan Persian for the immigrant children, because it's simply a financial impossibility.
On an impressionistic level, Americans are quite aware about language differences. I would have to say, and I don't mean this in any disrespectful way, Americans are, however, relatively uninformed about the significance and the meaning of language differences. And my personal goal in terms of education is I would like to see more accurate information in the American public about the nature of language differences. There is a mythology about what language differences mean, that language differences are related to moral issues, that language differences are related to basic intelligence, that language differences are related to exclusively to success. And these are the issues about which the American public is, in my considered opinion, somewhat uninformed.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the first of two discussions about language and linguistics. The panelists were Crawford Fagan of the University of Virginia at Falls Church, Walt Wolfram of the University of the District of Columbia, and Ron Butters of Duke University. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about language and gender. My guest will be Charis Cremeray, a professor at the University of Illinois. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for the first of three discussions about language and linguistics. Poets have written that speech is the creator of thought, the measure of the universe. Or, by contrast, that words can slip, slide, perish, and decay with imprecision. But what do professional linguists say about speech and the use of words? How do Americans use English? To what social, aesthetic, or political ends? Listen for answers and insights as three social linguists discuss these and other questions. American Talk, Part 1, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.